Hello, and thanks for joining us for today's Applicant Update webinar. I'd like to cover a few things before we begin. This webinar is being recorded. Recordings and supporting materials will be published on the new GTLD microsite. The running time of the webinar is 90 minutes. We'll start with a presentation and end with a question and answer session. You can ask a question via phone or in the Adobe Connect questions and comments pod. Phone questions will be given priority, and questions submitted online will be answered if time permits. Dial-in numbers can be found on the webinars page of the microsite at http://newgtlds.icann.org/webinars. The conference ID is Applicant Webinar Update. To enter the phone queue, dial *1. To exit the queue, dial *2. Please make sure that your phone is not on speaker when you ask a question. Now I'd like to turn it over to Christine Ouellette, Vice President, GTLD Operations.
Thank you, Nicole. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Happy to be here today. We're going to cover a lot of materials in this Applicant Update webinar. You can see we are on the agenda slide for today's webinar, and we have quite a bit of material to cover. I will do my typical review of initial evaluation status, and we just lost our presentation. And then we will be going into talking about our continuing operations instruments that are part of initial evaluation and discussing some issues there. I'll be covering some general status around objections and dispute resolution, talking about the spring contention resolution methods and where we're at on operational readiness, talk about contracting and timing, a brief update on pre-delegation testing, as well as GAC advice, provide everyone with some information about security and stability studies that have begun, give you an update on the trademark clearinghouse, talk about our announced data escrow providers, and then talk about the program timeline. So that will be our agenda for the day. Good morning. So we'll start with initial evaluation. Initial evaluation, as of this past Friday, we have published results for applications through priority number 600. We have released results for 518 applications which have passed initial evaluation, 4 applications which are eligible for extended evaluation, 60 applications are still on hold due to CQs, change requests, outreach, or other evaluation, and 18 withdrawn applications out of the first 600. As we release the results for application status, you can find the link for all of the current application status at the bottom of the page. There are essentially 3 possible outcomes for initial evaluation. One is to pass initial evaluation. Secondly, you've seen some results for applications that are eligible for extended evaluation or applications which are ineligible for further review. This is a slightly updated graph from previous months. What I'm trying to display here is the application result status by application results per 100 priority batch. So, for instance, out of the first 108, you see that 101 were a pass of initial evaluation. You see 4 are at the top there, withdrawn, on hold, et cetera. The green are the 2 withdrawn, and the red reflects the EE. I think the purple legend is incorrect. The purple legend there should just discussing on hold. It shouldn't say pass EE or withdrawn. So we will correct this before we publish these slides. So, as you can see, from the earliest weeks to the most recent batch of results that were released last Friday, we have more results on hold for recent weeks, but that number is less from those earlier phases of work, from those earlier weeks of results. As of this morning, there have been 71 applications withdrawn out of the initial 1930, leaving us with 1,859 active applications in the program. And you see that we've published results for 518 from through all of initial evaluation. Strength similarity reflects the results of the entire strength similarity evaluation. I'd like to now talk about one aspect of initial evaluation. In particular, it's the continuing operations instrument, or as many of us think about it, the letters of credit, most commonly, or LOCs. As per the guidebook, the intention and purpose of the continuing operations instrument is to ensure that the applicant has the funds necessary to provide a continuity of service once they should any issues with registry operations arise. Specification 8 of the registry agreement requires the continuing operations instrument. Most applicants have opted to utilize a letter of credit format tool as that instrument. Question 50 of the application provides for the assessment of that continuing operations instrument and is intended to assess the applicant's ability to meet the requirements of Spec 8. However, the scoring requirements for Q50 are distinct and separate from the requirements of Spec 8. Spec 8 is very much a portion of the registry agreement or contract, and it's a legal document, whereas the assessment and criteria in question 50 are intended to assess the financial capability of the applicant. A little more information, and I know most of you participating are applicants, so you're probably even more familiar with these criteria in the guidebook than I am, but for those of you who may not be as versed in the details of question 50 and our COI criteria, the guidebook requires a number of business attributes about the COI or letters of credit. It has to be written for a sufficient dollar amount or funding level. It must be issued by an A-rated bank or financial institution. If it covers multiple strings, it has to specify the amount allocated for each of those strings. ICANN must be identified as the designee and beneficiary. The COIs have to be in place for 5 years, beginning as per the opening of the application window, January 2012, and the LOCs or COIs were to be unconditional. So this criteria is all in the AGB. Again, this is a shorthand, non-legal version of the criteria, but I wanted to reiterate this for the rest of our discussion on COIs. We published a number of applicant advisories about the continuing operations instrument, which were intended to assist applicants in understanding the expectations for question 50 and give them the information to maximize their opportunity for scoring on question 50. So there was an announcement in December 2011 prior to the application window opening about the bank rating and the amount required, funding level required for the COI. There was an additional advisory published These are slightly out of sequence. In February of this year, on beneficiary requirements and an advisory on the conditions of conditionality language in the LLC, which was published in December 2012. And updated, I'm told, in March of this year. So the intention of these advisories were to provide the applicants with as much information to as possible so that you could all submit LOCs or other instruments that scored the full potential 3 points on question 50. However, what's come to light during the initial evaluation process is that despite clearly a lot of good efforts by applicants to utilize the unconditional language examples that were provided in the advisories, that there were some confusion, some inconsistent application and usage of that conditional language, and applicants some applicants have been providing LOCs that only reference some of the conditions and not all of the conditions that would make an acceptable and quote-unquote unconditional letter of credit. Also complicating this, as some of you are aware, there are some financial institutions that refuse to issue unconditional letters of credit. And this is made more challenging because the initial evaluation process was not built or designed to facilitate extended exchanges and dialogue about these issues between ICANN and the evaluation panels, the applicants, and the banks. So these advisories were a mechanism to provide that information. Based on this inconsistency of using this conditional language, we are choosing to focus the evaluation of question 50 on the financial aspects of the continuing operations instruments. And the final evaluation of COIs against specification 8, including conditionality, will remain part of the contracting process. Our panels are not assessing the financial capability of the applicants, not the legal language. We're going to address the legal language regarding conditionality at the point of contracting now. So why am I talking about this for 6 slides, and what does this mean to you? So first and foremost, I want to make clear there is no impact on any of the published IE results or outcomes to date. So no outcome, whether passing initial evaluation or being eligible for extended evaluation, is affected by this focus on the business aspects and business criteria of the LOCs. What this does mean is that approximately 15% of the applications that have passed initial evaluation to date, so approximately 15% of the 600 published, will have their initial evaluation scores for question 50 updated from 1 point to 3 points. The IE outcome will still remain a pass. Due to the timing of the program and our desire to continue to meet our objectives of publishing results for 100 applications per week, we will not be updating these IE reports that have already been published at this time. Our intention is to update the reports by the end of initial evaluation for those that previously scored 1 point and now would score 3 points. This focus on the business criteria will have no impact to the four applications that are recommended for extended evaluation. And this approach to evaluation of question 50 will be reflected in the IU results and the reports starting this Friday, June 7th. So, can we go back up, Nicole? So, I anticipate that during our Q&A at the end of the session, we will receive a number of questions about this, and I'm happy to entertain as many of those questions as we can in the time permitting. So, I feel that this is a this focus is going to improve our ability to meet our schedule of publishing IU results, and that this is a very valid representation of the intention of the criteria in the AGB around question 50. So we will now segue to other topics for the remainder of the webinar, and we will come back to answer any questions on this topic and others at the end. Okay? Moving on to objections and dispute resolution. As you can see, we're highlighting that we're in this stage of applicants responding to objections, and where those responses have already been received by the DRSP, the expert panels are in the process of being selected by the DRSPs. We have a total of 262 admissible objections filed with the three DRSPs. To date, they are publishing that they have received 139 admissible responses by applicants. There are still 119 filings in review, and four filings have been dismissed due to applicant withdrawal. Circumstances that may alter process timing. So in so much as a required timing has been defined for the objection and dispute processing, there are other conditions that are allowed for in the guidebook, in the AGB, that may impact the timing of specific objection processing. It could be applicant responses sooner, later, the payments of applicants, et cetera. The complexity of objection filings, the DRSPs have at the discretion to consolidate objections if it makes sense. And then there may be additional activities that are part of the dispute resolution process, hearings, submissions, negotiation, mediation, et cetera. So ICANN is overseeing the objection process. However, it is being managed by the dispute resolution service providers. Moving on to string contention resolution, which comprises community priority evaluation and options. So as we discussed last month and I mentioned, I think first in Beijing, we intend to begin contention proceedings in September of this year. As I promised last month, we would revisit the opportunity for community applicants to elect community priority evaluation. And we will begin accepting CPE elections by the end of next week via the customer portal. So look for an announcement on that. There will be instructions on how to elect that. There are fees associated with that. All of that information on the timing will be available in announcement by next week. As you see in the graphic at the bottom of the slide, CPE is intended to take place both after initial evaluation and possibly again after extended evaluation, based on depending on which applicants are in go to extended evaluation and if they are in contention with community applicants. So, or if the community applicants go to extended evaluation. So we anticipate that CPE will occur in more than one phase. As for auctions, intention sets which do not include community priority applicants or community applicants not seeking CPE could begin after initial evaluation and do not necessarily wait, do not necessarily need to wait until after the first round of community priority evaluation is done. So we intend to start the first round of auctions at the same time that the first round of CPE is occurring. After the first round of CPE, we may have another round of auctions that includes those contention sets containing CPE or community applicants, and then you can see additional rounds. So we anticipate multiple auction rounds starting in October of this year. We are we continue to work on the becoming operationally ready for both CPE and auctions, working with the with vendors to perform the services and putting together more details. We anticipate having much more information on both CPE and auctions by the Durban session next month. Moving on to contracting and the registry agreement. The public comment period on the registry agreement closes in a month, in a week, next week, the 11th of June. And next week, Thursday, the 13th of June, the team here will be holding an applicant webinar to discuss the contracting process. And it's not specifically to discuss the agreement, which is already posted and comments will have been submitted for, but to discuss the process. So that information is here. I encourage you to participate and get your questions answered about beginning that contracting process. CAC advice. The new GTLD program committee sought applicant public comments regarding the GAC advice regarding safeguards. And that response window closed on the 4th of June. So the public comment and summary of the summary of public comments will be developed and published as per typical process and timing. We have also received individual applicant responses to GAC advice. Submitted to the board. That window closed for applicants on the 10th of May, and we published the 380 responses on the 23rd of May. So those are now out and available via the microsite to download individually, and I'm looking to my team in bulk as a set. That's a very large file. So those have been compiled. Pre-delegation testing. So we discussed after Beijing, due to the fact that the registry agreement was going out for public comment again, and we were the board is in the midst of considering GAC advice, that it might be worthwhile to continue what we had originally called pilot testing of pre-delegation testing. We changed the scope of the test slightly, and we expanded the number of participants, and we are now performing what we're calling beta testing of PDT. To date, more than 200 applications or applicants have been invited to participate in PDT beta testing. We've invited at least one application per registry service provider as known. We are accepting and offering pre-del testing dates through the 15th of July 2013. To date, we have only had 30 scheduled tests, 30 applicants who have opted in to participate in PDT beta testing from 17 RSPs. So that was slightly surprisingly low response and participation level in beta testing. The good news on beta testing is that the results have improved since the pilot, and the test results are anticipated from the output of beta testing approximately 2 weeks after the testing process closes. We also discussed last month that the community, many of the, several of the RSPs had concerns about the methodology we were using to test Anycast. We've listened and we are developing alternative methods. In fact, we are eliminating the Anycast instance testing. There will be an announcement coming out later this week, possibly as early as tomorrow, with more details about the new methods and procedures for the test. So you can expect to also receive updated test specifications and data input templates to support this beta testing. We are currently in discussions as to whether this change to the Anycast testing methodology will be implemented during beta testing or for production PDT. Depending on the timing of implementation with the service provider, we would consider offering this revised testing methodology during beta testing. However, we want to ensure that we don't impact our ability to meet our production timelines around pre-delegation testing, and that all outstanding issues are addressed by the time we anticipate having production pre-del testing slots. registry data escrow. There was an announcement last week, I believe. We have selected two organizations to provide data escrow services. They've been approved, Iron Mountain and the NCC Group. We have received additional applications, and we are in the process of evaluating those applications. We want to make sure that we have data escrow providers that meet all of the criteria and are appropriately skilled to provide this critical service and function. But we also want to offer the all of you applicants and our registry service providers options for your data escrow service. You can see the link to that information at the bottom of the page. We have recently commissioned two new studies on security and stability. The first is a study on the delegation of applied for new utility strings that are currently used in private networks. We are doing this in collaboration with the SFAC. And we also have a study which has been started on the impact of dotless domain names. And we're doing this based on concerns and recommendations of the SAC 53 report. So these studies are intended to identify and classify potential risk levels and give ICANN information about mitigation options as necessary. You can see the announcement of those studies via the link below. IDN variants. The IDN variant TLD program has an upcoming webinar on June 27th. They're going to cover a variety of topics. So that's something I anticipate many will have interest in. I encourage you to participate in that prior to the Durban meeting. Moving on to the Trademark Clearinghouse and the Verification Service. So the Trademark Clearinghouse is currently in production by Deloitte. They tell us, they are reporting that there are 636 registered trademark holder users and 119 agents have registered. There are over 3,000 records have been submitted, trademark records have been submitted to the TMCH. 1,300 maybe are verified, over 1,100 in process, 503 incorrect, and 12 invalid. At this time, because we have not yet had the first and or started the first sunrise period, we're still in this early bird submission phase. So the one-year registration of your trademarks has not started. That one-year window begins upon the first sunrise. So you sort of get the free time for your registration. There is a webinar planned specifically for the Trademark Clearinghouse to discuss internationalized domain names and IDNs on the 19th of June. So I'm just marketing all of the upcoming webinars today. So another opportunity to engage and discuss the TMCH and specifically IDN registrations and usage in the TMCH. There are a number of other critical things in process around the Trademark Clearinghouse. The development of the Sunrise and Claims functionality by IBM is ongoing and continues as planned. We are, and a part of this implementation includes the implementation of the straw man model and the implementation of the rights protection mechanisms and requirements for registries. ICANN and the team, Karen Lentz, Cyrus Namazi, have engaged with a self-organized, self-identified team amongst the registries to discuss concerns and issues with the RPM requirements document. And they are working with this group to revise the document. And as those changes are finalized, those will again be published for public input. So the last slide is the new GTLD program timeline. This is unchanged. We're looking at finalizing the registry agreement in late June. There are board meetings scheduled. The board continues to address GAC advice. After those are completed, we anticipate beginning the contracting process in late June. As I mentioned, we're conducting already started pre-delegation beta testing. And as soon as contracting kicks off, then we will move on to pre-delegation testing. The other green bars reflect the operational readiness of the other key systems supporting new GTLDs, the Trademark Clearinghouse Sunrise and Claim Systems, URF, and EBRO. So last month, I promised you another timeline, an earliest path timeline, and we're going to switch over and discuss that now. So I'm calling this the earliest path to the first new GTLD. It's most definitely a tentative timeline. It's dependent on a bunch of things out of staff control, namely the registry agreement being approved by the end of June. That's a board decision. Should that happen, we anticipate that the first new GTLD contracts could be approved in the week following. Then we would move on to pre-delegation testing. Between opting into pre-delegation testing, performance of the test, and reporting after the test, you see about a month of elapsed time for pre-delegation testing. That assumes that the applicant has participated in the beta testing to expedite the pre-delegation testing. One moment. Sorry for the interruption. Then, beyond pre-delegation testing, the new GTLD team is responsible for reporting the results and progress of the applicant and the application through all of the new GTLD processes. So we have a few days there to transition the applicant to IANA to provide credentials, reporting, et cetera. Then you see the IANA delegation. That reflects two elapsed weeks for IANA delegation. And then you will see we anticipate August 28th could be the date for having the first new GTLD delegated. Beyond that, then the applicant, once delegated, could begin the Sunrise process. They need to request a date from the TNCH provider and publish a notice, giving 30 days notice of this for Sunrise, and then the Sunrise would commence. So we would be looking for the first Sunrise period to happen between the end of September and the end of October for that first 30-day Sunrise. I'm going to make a few adjustments before we publish the slide. We've got a little word wrapping transition. I think we had a couple of anomalies as we converted to PDF. But I wanted to share this tentative timeline. This is dependent on a lot of things beyond the program operations. This is not and is not intended to reflect some sort of ongoing steady state timeline. This is most definitely an expedited path since we have many applications now which are approved through initial evaluation and would be eligible to begin contracting as soon as that registry agreement is approved. So this is the timeline that we will be using for that. As it gets updated, we will certainly let you know. We will make sure that by the end of the week, this timeline is also published to the new GTLD microsite, along with the other program timeline. I think that is all I have for presentation. 40 minutes, not too bad. So we will take a moment, and I will ask the operator to look at calls we have in the queue, and the team here will begin to gather questions from the pod. So let's take a moment while we give the operator the opportunity to let people dial in and take questions. So we'll hold for just one moment.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question over the phone, please press star 1 to get into the question queue.
So, operator, do we have anyone in the queue?
Just one moment. Our first question is from the line of Christina Rosette with Covington. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much, Christine. I have a few questions about the GAC advice. The first being what process or analytical framework is being used by the new GTLD program committee to evaluate that advice? And within that framework, what role do the applicant responses have?
Hi, Christina. Thank you so much for the question. So the in terms of the process that the new GTLD program committee is using, that's not something it would be appropriate for me to discuss or speak to. The NGPC has published information about their considerations and the timing of their anticipated consideration of GAC advice. Applicant responses, what I can say is that applicant responses have been provided, not only published to everyone, all 380 individual responses, but staff has summarized those responses to the new GTLD program committee for their consideration. Those responses and all documents as the board meetings will ultimately be published as part of board minutes, once meeting minutes are approved, et cetera.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Christina.
Our next question is from the line of Sarah Langstone with VeriSign. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, a number of our customers are closed brand applicants, and as such, they're planning to request exemption from the code of conduct as specified in the guidebook. I was wondering if you could provide any information about that process or when that information about the process would be available, please.
Sarah, thank you very much for the question. I do not have information today about requesting the exemption to the code of conduct. I will share that with the team, and I will suggest that we address it in the contracting webinar next week on the 13th of June. Thank you for the question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from the line of Jeff Newman with Newstar. Go ahead.
Hi, Christine. How are you?
I'm well. How are you, Jeff?
Good, thanks. I have two quick, well, maybe not quick, but two questions on the COI, or the letter of credit, and then one quick question on the data escrow. So I'll do the two on the letter of credit. So did I understand you correctly when you said that, or the way I interpreted what you said, and hopefully I'm wrong, is that you said that even if you got a 3 or get a 3 in your evaluation for the letter of credit, that still does not necessarily mean that when it comes down to the contracting process, I can still may come to you and say it's still not sufficient, we need to fix the letter of credit. Is that sort of what I heard?
Thank you, Jeff. So some applicants did submit letters of credit that met all requirements of the AGB and the registry agreement spec 8 and will not need to obtain a new LOC during the contracting process. However, others submitted letters of credit that met all the financial conditions and therefore received a score of 3 in question 50 but did not meet all of the detailed contractual requirements. So some applicants will need to submit new LOCs during the contracting process.
Thank you, Christine. Not the answer I was hoping for, but when it comes down to the contracting, I guess you'll talk about this in the webinar next week. You know, what is it that will let the applicant know beforehand, or is it possible to let the applicant know beforehand? Because as you know, or you may not know, but for the applicant, it takes a number of weeks to actually get revised letters of credit, and so it's not a short process. And if what you said at the beginning of that section, which is some financial institutions don't give that kind of unconditional language, then the question really is, perhaps rather than asking all the applicants to change their letters of credit, maybe revising the language in Specification 8 to make it more realistic realistic to what financial providers, well-known A-plus financial providers, are willing to give. I think maybe an easier solution than actually requiring all the applicants to go back and get new letters of credit, especially if the intention can be of what the guidebook is trying to protect against can be upheld. That's my comment. And then on the data escrow, it's my understanding that you've now accredited two providers. Does that mean that if an applicant enters into a contract with any one of those providers, or either of those providers, or any new ones you accredit, that ICANN will automatically accept that contract during the contracting process and therefore will not require any negotiation? Or is there some sort of template that ICANN has negotiated with the escrow providers that will be coming out to guide the applicants on what kind of contract they should sign?
So, Jeff, thanks for that. Yes, you're correct. Each of those providers have an approved template to be used. If they are not yet published, they will be published shortly. We recognize that that's critical to having acceptable agreements in place. Both those agreements and, as you pointed out, working towards acceptable language in the letters of credit is critical. And that's a major impetus behind the June 13th webinar. And there will be extensive discussions about language that meets the criteria of Spec 8. Thank you. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. Next question is from the line of Donna Austin with ARI. Please go ahead.
Hi, Christine. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. How are you, Donna?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Great.
During the Beijing meeting, you indicated this is a question in relation to change requests. So you advised that applicants that submitted change requests after the delivery of preliminary evaluation results would have those change requests considered at the time of contracting. What I would like to understand is what is the process that you will use to consider change requests at that time? So is it going to be similar to the process that you currently go through at the moment, or is it going to be something different?
Okay. Donna, thank you. In Beijing, we did mention that change requests after IE results are posted could be addressed at the point of contracting. What we are seeing is that there are some very significant change requests that are being submitted, changing RFCs, changing significant portions of the application, which affect the financial capability. We have already had numerous applications go through re-evaluation due to the nature of the change request. So when I spoke in Beijing, the possibility for change requests around, a new director or a phone number and address changes, which we see dozens of, those would certainly be addressed at the point of contracting. However, there are other changes that we look at for every single change request submitted, and we assess if if it impacts, if it would impact the outcome of the evaluation, and if it is significant enough to require reevaluation, we are doing so. I should note for everyone on the call, and not just to address your question, that applicants are being required to pay additional fees for this reevaluation, and those fees are dependent on the how many evaluations need to be reperformed, if it is just the financial reevaluation or if it's financial, technical, registry services, et cetera, then reevaluation has to be done. Typically, reevaluation is potentially necessary if the CQs have been issued, if the entire evaluation has been completed. Does that answer your question, Donna?
So I just want to clarify what I think I heard, but I'm not sure. So for administrative changes, so a new director or change in phone numbers, that kind of change will be addressed at contracting. But for anything that's more significant, you will try to... I'm a little bit confused about the timing for any of the more significant changes, like a change to an RSP. If that change request comes through during the initial evaluation period, is it likely that you will make a decision that re-evaluation is required, and that will be addressed at that time? I'm really confused about what I think I heard.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Donna. I want to make sure that I'm being clear. So when I previously spoke and discussed change requests being addressed at the point of contracting, I was referring to ICANN's processes and procedures. For instance, when a new board member is added or changed to an applicant, we go through and perform background screening on that applicant. If we already have the IE results published, or even if we haven't published the IE results, but we have the entire results from the panel, we wouldn't re-perform background screening in its entirety. We would perform background screening of that new director at the point of contracting to be completed at the point of contracting. So that's one type of change, and that's the type of change I was speaking of being addressed at the point of contracting. If there are application changes, such as a change to an RSP, if the RSP changes and the IE results have been published, that application has to be completely reevaluated, and we have no mechanism, i.e. it's done. Once we publish IE results and that report is made public, the option, as per the guidebook section 127 of the guidebook, the options are for the application to be evaluated in extended evaluation or in a subsequent round. So if the change request significantly alters the application, we would review that. It would certainly go through our standard change review process and could potentially result in the application going through extended evaluation. If the results have been provided to us by the panel, however, ICANN has not compiled them and published the results for an applicant, and we receive a change that would require reevaluation. As we have, I mentioned other instances where other applications have been reevaluated. That is the situation those applications have been in. The IE results have not been published, and they're in various states of completion by the panel. We ask the panel to reevaluate those applications. And that is the type of reevaluation that would occur during initial evaluation. But if the initial evaluation is completed and results are posted, then change requests would have to happen in extended evaluation. Or after the PLD is delegated, you can work through the registry team to initiate changes post-delegation. Does that help, Donna?
Yeah, so basically it falls to the timing. It's a timing issue. So when, depending on where the application is in the process and when ICANN receives the change request, that kind of is the determining factor as to whether it can be considered during initial evaluation or whether it would be post-evaluation, and of course there's consequences with that that may require re-evaluation or even consideration in the next round.
Correct. You know, given this dialogue, I think it would be helpful. I will have our team put together some FAQs around change requests, and we will get something published next week to make sure that this dialogue is captured and shared with all applicants, even those who may not be able to participate in the webinar.
Okay, so I did submit these questions around this to the customer service about 2 weeks ago, so the basis of my questions are in that request.
So, yes, so it's, I understand. I saw the request and question.
Yes.
So, understand that it's very
helpful. Yes. I'm not complaining about the time frame. I'm just letting you know that they were submitted. So if you need further information about where I'm coming from, the questions are there.
Thank you very much, Donna. Operator?
Yes, our next question is from the line of Charles Gomes with VeriSign. Please go ahead.
Hi, Christine, and thanks for the good presentation. I'm two questions. The first one's a follow-up to Donna's because I don't think I quite got it straight in my head when a reevaluation would occur versus extended evaluation. And along that line, if I understood you correctly early on in response to Donna, you said there would be additional fees for reevaluation. We know there are fees with extended evaluation. So could you clarify briefly what when it would be a reevaluation versus an extended evaluation?
Thanks, Chuck. Thanks for the question. I definitely want to be clear as possible here. The reevaluation could only happen before initial evaluation is completed and results are published. You know, today is Wednesday. We have results queued up that will be published this Friday. From our perspective, those are published. They may not be published, but they are complete. Once those IU results are published, we can't re-perform initial evaluation. So then that, it is a timing issue, as Donna noted. Once those IU results are published, then the option is for the application to go through extended evaluation.
Okay, thank you. I think that makes it clear. Second question. In your best case scenario, am I correct in assuming that assumes no impact on the registry agreement from GAC Advice, or for that matter, the RAA?
That is correct. It's basically assuming that the registry agreement approved by the end of June could be used to begin contracting. Any impact as a result of GAC Advice and board action to accept GAC Advice, if the method of acceptance were to change the registry agreement, then we'd have to look at that beginning date, possibly, potentially.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck.
Our next question is from the line of Lillian Posteris with Fairwinds Partners. Please go ahead.
Hi, Christine. Following up on Jeff Newman's question about applicants that, you know, scored a 1 or scored 3 points on the letter of credit but will need to, you know, amend the letter of credit at contracting, at that stage, will applicants and banks be able to, you know, talk to ICAM Legal directly about, you know, if they're meeting the requirements, which, as you said, wasn't able to be done during this phase?
Yes, Lillian, thank you for the question. Yes, during the contracting process, once the applicant is eligible for contracting and I can initiate that contracting process with the applicant, you will have the opportunity to engage with our legal team to discuss the criteria, your specific LLC, as it's been amended. We have LLCs that have 3 and 4 amendments. So clearly we saw a lot of applicants that were attempting to adopt the conditional, acceptable conditional language of the advisories. So through working with our legal team, as we begin this contracting process, you'll have very specific dialogue about your current LLC. And that's, I just reiterate, that's also part of what we wanted to discuss on the 13 June webinar and the criteria around LLCs. I understand that I don't know that it will be done for the 13 June webinar. I'm looking around the room with my team. I know that our legal team is working to craft a complete set of acceptable LLC language that we have seen from various banks, various institutions. So I expect that that would be forthcoming. If not at the next week's webinar, then shortly thereafter.
All right.
Does
thank
that
you
help
very
me?
Much.
Thank
you.
Yes, thanks.
At this time, there are no further questions on the phone
queue. Thank you so much. So we're going to begin taking questions from the pod. The team here does a great job in pulling them and assembling them for us. I will ask Trang Nguyen to process those questions.
Thanks, Christine. The first question from the pod is from Henry Chan. Will PDT beta test participants be able to take part in other parts of the beta test if they fail to provide a sample data escrow agreement?
Oh, there you are. Thank you, Henry. Yes, if a beta test participant does not have an existing data escrow agreement, they can still fully participate in other aspects of beta pre-delegation testing. Since we only have the 2 data escrow agents approved, but we are still expecting more, so we anticipate that applicants may work and may take some time for them to get their data escrow agreements in place. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question comes from Tim Switzer. Christine, can you provide any updates as to the new GTLD Global Outreach Program led by Sally Costerton?
Tim, thank you for the question. You know what? Let me check with Sally and her team to get an update for you. I don't have any information at this time on that program. But as we have done for previous webinars, we will add that to the list of questions and answers, and we will provide an update after the webinar. Thank you.
Thanks, Christine. Next one is from Gerardo. What is the status of the applications being withheld, and why is there no information on timing and process of these? Who can give proper feedback on what is happening with the held applications?
Gerardo, I understand the question, and I understand how important the question is to applicants. There are some applications being held back.
If we could bring up that graph on page 5 of the document to look at what's being withheld. So there are a number of applications that required additional evaluation to ensure a thorough and consistent result. Many of these applications are part of a portfolio of applications, and additional review is required to ensure consistency. So we look at, as part of our QA/QC process, we look at a number of dimensions of application and evaluation consistency. There are also some applications that have outstanding questions around background screening or require additional background screening. So that's another reason. However, the majority of applications that are being held are due to pending change requests, outreach, and outstanding CQs. The geographic name applications have until the end of the initial evaluation, currently end of August, to submit their CQs. And background screening CQs also do not have a definitive due date. So those are the reasons that individual applications are being withheld. As a general rule, my team communicates to the applicant on the week that their application is intended to be published based on priority number to indicate that the application is being held back for and for what reason, further evaluation, we would say it's background screening, a pending change request, et cetera. So we do communicate to the applicant information and for their specific result being withheld.
Thank you, Christine. Next question is from Ruben. Are all results of the GeoPanel finished? If so, could they be published right away instead of being reviewed with each application?
Thank you, Craig. So to Ruben's question, no, the geographic names panel has not finished its work. I just mentioned that there are still geographic names applications that have outstanding CQs. So there are some applications that are still going to be receiving CQs. So in so much as the geographic names evaluation is one panel within initial evaluation, we will be releasing the results for those applications once they are complete based on priority number. Again, this is those outstanding geographic name CQs could be a reason that individual applications results are withheld in a given week. Thank you, Ruben.
There you are. Thank you, Christine. Next question comes from, let me see, I'm losing my space here, comes from Jim Prendergast. What should applicants who are now in the process of responding to CQs about Q50, specifically the format of the LOC, do now?
Thank you, Jim, for the question. Let me be clear that all applicants should respond to the CQs and address all issues that are brought forth in those CQs. If applicants do not wish to address the conditionality issues brought forth in the CQ for their letter of credit, as I mentioned, we will not be reviewing and scoring Q50 on the basis of conditionality. But keep in mind, many of the CQs on question 50 in particular are for other issues, and those should be addressed in order to maximize the score on question 50. So we have provided advisories on question 50 and the conditionality, so those still stand. It's just not, the conditionality is not being evaluated with question 50. It will be addressed at the point of contracting.
Thanks, Christine. Next question comes from Jeff Newman. As opposed to requiring every applicant to change their COIs at the time of contracting, why not change the contract language to make it more realistic to reflect the realities of what financial institutions are prepared to agree to?
So I think we got that comment from Jeff when he was on the phone. I will certainly share that with our legal team and with Cyrus. I don't know about the how realistic it is to change the language in Spec 8. I don't think the intent is to churn and enforce unnecessary changes to LLC. So thank you, Jeff, again for the comment.
Next question comes from Jim Prendergast. How many objections would be inadmissible and on what grounds were those objections rejected?
Jim, thank you for the question. The DLSPs are in the process of finalizing which responses were inadmissible, and we are requesting from the DLSPs to reflect that progress on their website. It is really our expectation that the DLSPs would publish the status of their processing. Based on the nature of dispute resolution proceedings, the grounds for the inadmissible objections are not intended to be made publicly available. Thank you. Okay. I'm told that we have a caller on the phone, so we will pause on the questions from the pod and go to the phone. Operator?
Yes, we have a follow-up from the line of Christine Rosette. Christina Rosette, please go ahead.
Thanks very much. I didn't realize that you all would interrupt the pod question, so I'll relinquish my place, and if I get in through the pod, that would be great. But thank you.
Thank you, Christina. Not a problem. Trang, do you want to go on?
Right. Ooh, okay. If my microphone went off for a second there. Next question is from Avi. Does ICANN accept the legitimacy of private auctions, and will they enforce the decisions of those auctions?
I'm not in a position to speak to the legitimacy of private auctions. What we acknowledge is we see applicants that withdraw. So as applicants withdraw, we move on, and that affects the contention set. So we're abiding by the policies and procedures as discussed in the AGB. Thank you.
Next question is from Jim Prendergast. Can you tell us which providers are conducting the security and stability studies and when they were engaged?
Thank you, Jim. Inner Isle was engaged on May 9th to conduct a study on the security impacts of delegating applied for new GTLD strings that are currently used in private networks. And CARD Systems was engaged on 21 May to conduct a study on security and stability impacts of .list domain names. Thanks.
Thank you. Next question from Crystal Taylor. When would the updated score on Tier 50 be received? Not published. It would be useful to receive it sooner so refinements can be made to other applications.
Crystal, thank you for the question. We anticipate that the applicant reports and the public reports will be updated at the same time. Right now, I'm committing to the end of initial evaluation, which is the end of August. I would certainly hope to, we'd like to do it sooner, but we are, in fairness to all applicants, we want to continue to meet our objective of releasing IE results on a weekly basis. So that has to be our priority for now.
Thank you. Next question from Jim again. How many contracting slots will be available for applicants per week?
Thank you, Jim. You know what? I don't have a question, an answer to that question today. I expect that would be a great question for next week's contracting webinar.
Thank you. Next question from Jacob. Would there be a CPE session in Durban?
Mr. Jacob, we are still finalizing sessions for the Durban meeting, but we expect that CPE will be a topic of discussion in Durban.
Next question. Could you please elaborate more on the TMCH/registered IDNs work?
So the TMCH accepts trademark data from around the world, including marks using multiple scripts. The mark information is verified according to the issuing jurisdiction, and that TMCH record can then be used for Sunrise and claims processing based on matching rules to apply a record to matching domain names. We expect to go through this topic in more detail with IBM examples in the TMCH webinar on the 19th of June. So, thank you for that question.
Thank you. Next question is from Reg. Given the unilateral manner in which I can introduce the TMCH strawman model and the fact that the community continues to have concerns about it, how is its implementation consistent with transparency and stakeholder engagement?
So, Reg, ICANN is committed to implementing this based on the process and rationale that's already been described. This was not a unilateral process, but rather started from a proposal developed in consultation with stakeholders. The discussions on this have been transparent, including a public comment period and balancing of all of the feedback received.
Thank you. Next question from Jim. Timeline says the TMCH will be ready for claims in July 1st. That's under a month away. When will the interfaces be available for testing by registries and registrars?
So the timeline, Jim, has the TMCH on a single bar. So Sunrise is intended to be first in July, the claims following a month later. So claims wouldn't be in July. However, I need to defer. We had talked about testing happening in the June timeframe. I will look into that, and we'll put it out via the Q&A after the webinar to confirm if that is still the date. And I think we have someone on the phone. Shall we go to the operator?
Yes. Next question is a follow-up from the line of Jeff Newman with Newstar. Please go ahead.
Yes, thanks. I think you sort of answered the question where I was going to ask about when the interfaces are going to be made available for testing with the TMCH. I'm not sure I understood the answer. But then the follow-up is, when is the contract with IBM going to be published? I think we were told back in February when it was signed that it would be made public, but hasn't been yet. So if you could just answer those. Thanks.
So, Jeff, in terms of timeline for testing and the integration testing of the TMCH, I will follow up after this to get a confirmed date. We have been shooting for June. I'm not sure if that is still feasible, but I'll let everyone know through the Q&A. And in terms of the publishing the agreements, we still intend to do that. I will follow up with the team here and get you a better date and timeline to commit to publishing those documents.
Yeah, Christine, thanks. If you could do that, that's actually kind of vital because in the discussions that are taking place on the on possible changes to the RPMs, not to the RPM, sorry, to the requirements, some of the answers we've gotten back is, well, don't worry about it. That's taken care of in the ICANN agreement with IBM. But obviously, need to see something to make sure that to comfort ourselves if that's the case. So thank you.
So, Jeff, we will be publishing the agreements or portions thereof that we are allowed to publish. And if the agreement didn't call out necessarily straw man functionality, but we certainly have a mechanism to work with Deloitte and IBM to implement enhancements and changes, normal part of any outsourced service. So that certainly will be mechanism would be reflected in the agreements which and portions thereof which we publish.
Yeah, thanks, Christine. I'm looking more towards like service levels and you know defining the service and what it is that the IBM is actually doing for ICANN. That should be all scoped out, and that's you know not counting the straw man stuff. Again, that's a little portion. I'm talking about the service levels in general.
So, thank you, Jeff. I'm being told we intend to publish a term sheet summary of each agreement as well as the portions of the agreements that we are allowed to publish per our vendor agreements. And any information that is not clear from the documentation we publish, we would be happy to answer via a Q&A. So to make sure that any outstanding questions, such as SLAs, if it's not clear, are answered and addressed. So, thank you for that question. I think we have 7 minutes left on our timeline, and we'll go back to the Q&A pod for a few more questions.
Thanks, Christine. Next question is from Alexander Urbanis. To what extent, if any, has ICANN seen existing CCTLD operators make the case for possible stream confusion with applicants?
So CCTLD operators are afforded dispute mechanisms, the same dispute rights and objections as per the AGB. So I couldn't speak, I don't have any information on specific CCTLD objections. The DRSPs would be the source for all public information on objections filed.
Thanks, Christine. Next question is from Jacob. Is there a target start date in October for CPE, and is it still expected to take 6 to 12 weeks?
So, thank you, Jacob. We haven't published an explicit start date. We have said that CPE could begin as early as September after initial evaluation. There's certainly an opt-in period in which applicants have time even beyond the end of initial evaluation. All applicants will be afforded time to opt into CPE. The specific timing, we're still working to refine. It will largely be dependent on the evaluation procedures of the panel or panels to determine and confirm. So thank you for the question. As we have more information, we will certainly make that public.
Thanks, Christine. Next question from Steiner. Regarding the COI, no changes for published IE results slide. If an applicant is eligible for EE, but is upgraded to a score of 3 for Q50, then which deleted score, why should this applicant still be an EE?
Okay, so I'm going to ask, can we put that impact, no impact slide back up? To clarify, the four applications that are eligible currently for extended evaluation. We've reported results. They did not pass initial evaluation. However, they are eligible for extended evaluation. They are eligible. There is no impact to Q50, the scoring on Q50 for those applicants. Such a score change would not affect the outcome of those applicants. Even if they moved from a 1 to a 3, they would not be, they're not eligible to receive a 3 on Q50 given the details of those applications. So those are, the reason for their eligibility for extended evaluation is not based on their score of Q50, and there are no changes there. Okay, we just have a couple more minutes. Do we have any more questions? I have one on the phone, so we'll take our last question from the phone.
Yes, our last question is from the line of Yasmin Omar. Please go ahead.
Hi, Christine. Can you hear me?
Hi, Yasmin. Yes, thank you.
Great. So I just wanted to clarify, this is on the LOC once again. As a new GTLD applicant that has received a score of 3 on question 50, what certainty do I have that the LOC that I've provided meets the requirements of specification 8 during contracting and won't compromise my ability to proceed through the contracting process and execute a registry agreement as soon as possible?
So, thank you, Yasmin, for the question. So, if you received a score of 3 points on question 50, congratulations. And I would recommend that you review your existing LOC language against the requirements of Spec 8. So it's the requirements of Spec 8 that will be the yardstick for contracting. And all continuing operations instruments, LOCs, will be held to the criteria as specified in Spec 8.
But you're saying that there's no guarantee, even though I've scored 3 points, there's no guarantee that I won't be delayed at the time of contracting, specifically with respect to my ability to meet the requirements in Spec 8. Because up until now, we thought that we'd met all the requirements and the contracting process would be relatively smooth and there'd be no back and forth for the LOC. That does take considerable time. So what I'm hearing now is that there's potentially a 3 or 4 week delay before we can execute the agreement that wasn't anticipated beforehand. So if that is the case, there needs to be some sort of process beforehand that won't compromise our ability to execute the registry agreement as soon as possible, whereby we can get some sort of certainty that the LOC that we've provided meets the requirements of Spec 8.
So the requirements of Specification 8 have always been the requirements for contracting. And the criteria and scoring of question 50 are separate and distinct from the contractual requirements of Spec 8. So, but I understand your point that you would like to work in advance of contracting to remediate your LOC. We will be having the webinar on the 13th of June. We will, either at that webinar or shortly thereafter, be providing more information about ideal and recommended language for LOCs. I recommend that you assess your own LOC and get legal advice to review your LOC language against the Specification 8 criteria to provide you with a bit more insight to how that will stand up. We are working to provide more visibility into the expectations and criteria around LOCs in advance of each applicant's eligibility for contracting. So understand, and we are working to address this need that some applicants will have to amend their LLCs. Thank you, Yasmin.
Thanks, Christine.
So with that, we are out of time. Thank you to everyone for your questions, participating on the phone, participating in the pod. As usual, I think we got through most of our questions this week, but if we have a few unanswered questions and things we said we would follow up on, we will gather those and publish those within the next 2 weeks. Thank you to all. Thanks to the team here who supported me. I personally don't have another update webinar, so my next update will be in Durban. Thank you very much. See you in Durban.